Hi, this is Randall Schwartz, host of Floss Weekly. This week, Dan Lynch joins me. We're going to talk about a whole new programming language. It's kind of like C, kind of like C++, kind of like everything else. It's called the D language. You're not going to want to miss this, so stay tuned.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Floss Weekly is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Floss Weekly with Randall Schwartz and Dan Lynch. Episode 311, recorded October 8th, 2014. The D language. It's time for Floss Weekly, the show about free, libre, open-source software. I am your host, Randall Schwartz, Merlin at StoneEngine.com, bringing you each week, or as often as I can, the movers, the shakers, the big projects, the little projects, projects you might be using every day and being unaware of it, projects you might know nothing about but may want to go try out right after this show. Each week, I'm joined by a wonderful co-host. This week is no exception, Dan Lynch. Welcome back to the show.
Hey, Randall, it's good to be back.
Very cool, very cool. And you're speaking to us, I presume, from your secret bunker in Liverpool?
Yes, this is my secret hideout, much like the Batcave. This is my secret Batcave here in Liverpool in the UK, yes.
In the UK, right, not some other Liverpool. I don't know if there might be other ones, but it's certainly not there. And for those that are actually watching the video, you can also see that I am back at ZipRecruiter, my favorite client in Los Angeles area here, Santa Monica, actually. Don't have the Big Blue Yeti, sorry. Big Blue Yeti got left in Portland because I'm sort of traveling a little bit lighter these days. But hopefully you all can hear me just fine with my little portable headset that I'm using for today. This is not this week in locations. This is actually a show about open source software. Today is no exception. We have a couple of wonderful guests on to talk about the D programming language, which is a successor to the C programming language, as the old joke goes. We'll have them explain that as well, but let me see if I can get the pronunciation of the names here right, and then we'll talk to you, Dan, for a second. We've got two guests on. They're going to be talking about the D language. That'd be two of the key developers, Andre Alexandrescu, something sort of like that. He'll probably pronounce it better later in a second, and Walter Bright. So they're going to be on in a second. I've been looking this over. It's a really fascinating language. I'm a polyglot language-wise, so I've got a lot of background in a lot of different languages, including C, C++, and a bunch of other things, and I actually have some questions that I want to ask based on my experience with these languages. Dan, you're not much of a programmer, but what do you think about what you're able to scan before we started here?
Well, apart from saying their logo is very nice, I can do a little bit more than that. I've been having a look through. Looks really interesting. I used to be a Java developer many years ago. I'm recovering. Okay. I was also a C# developer for a while on .NET, so it doesn't look too, it's not too unfamiliar. I mean, I know that's not C, it's not C++ or D even, but you know, I'd like to think I can think of some interesting things to ask about. It looks like a really interesting project.
Very cool, very cool. Well, without further ado, let's go ahead and bring on our guests one at a time. Andre Alexandrescu, something like that. Welcome to the show.
This is awesome. Great pronunciation, Randall. Thanks.
So pretty darn close. And where are you speaking to us from?
I'm in San Francisco. I'm at home, and this is kind of a drab background for all I could do for now in a hurry.
Well, given that most of our guests most of our listeners are actually listeners rather than viewers, that's not bad. They don't even know. You could say, hey, I'm on a Ferris wheel, and nobody would know. So,
all right, I'm on a Ferris wheel.
There you go. Okay, very good, very good. And also, let's bring on Walter Bright. Walter, welcome to the show.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Very cool. And where are you speaking to us from?
I'm in Seattle, Washington.
So Seattle.
It's a nice cloudy day up here, as usual.
And but I don't see any rain. Where's the rain?
Well, it is overcast, so it's expected any moment.
Of course. Well, I'm from Portland, Oregon, obviously, and if you don't already know, and Seattle, of course, is very similar weather, so I'm pretty good with that. So let's start with you, Andre. Why don't you give us the sort of 30,000-foot view? What is the D language, and what problem is it trying to solve?
I think in a nutshell, D is trying to be good at everything C++ is good at, and also be good at a lot of stuff that C++ is not good at. So this would be our high level view, and we define our goals that way because we understood that there's no successor to C++ unless it does everything that C++ is good at just as good. And then a lot of stuff that C++ is not good at, just as good.
Okay, and so what I was taking a look at the documentation, which is extensive, by the way. I was actually paging through it quickly just to skim each page, and it still is like 300 pages of things I didn't get to skim through quite yet. So how did D come about? How did it get started?
I think Walter would be better to answer that, so let me defer to him, okay?
Sure. Walter, take that one.
Pretty much, I've developed a C compiler in the 80s and a C++ compiler in the 90s. And so I kind of got to be intimately familiar with what I wanted in the language and what I didn't want. And I kind of got frustrated with complaining about the things that I thought ought to be better, and finally decided how to do something about it and implement a language that was kind of how I felt it should be. And all of my friends and colleagues told me that it would never work, of course, because that's what always happens. And I started working on it on the side, and some other people found out about it and posted it on Slashdot, and soon it became a real language and people were excited about it, and it's been going ever since.
So
it was originally It was originally called the Mars programming language, but, you know, my friends would joke around about it and call it the D programming language. And pretty soon I just kind of threw in the towel and says, well, it's going to be called D because that's what we all call it.
So in terms of interacting with computers, I want to put the different categories here because you're in the top tier of four that I'm going to talk about. Well, there's users, people who just download programs and run them. There's people who write code. Well, actually, no, what's the middle? People who – maybe there's only three categories. Okay, I should probably plan this before I start my sentences. But then there's people who – well, okay, there's people who compile code. Let's put it that way. So they can download stuff and compile it and maybe make small modifications to it, but they're not actually authoring a big program or whatever. Then there's people who are actually writing programs from scratch and building that all up. But you're in that next category up, which is people that write programs that compile other programs. What's the transition from being a programmer to being a compiler designer, and why?
Well, I got my start programming the Empire computer game, which kind of started the whole military strategy game genre, and the game ran too slowly. Mm. So I started looking at what the compiler did to make programs run faster, how it compiled them. And I just kind of got fascinated with compilers and naturally dissatisfied with the state of compilers that existed and thought I could do better. I think you're kind of seeing a theme here with how I operate. I also have my own text editor, by the way. So I like writing my own tools, and I like writing my own compilers because then I get to control from front to back the code is generating. So,
of course, the downside of that is that you're not leveraging off anybody else's work. I mean, I get to just invoke GCC and it works, or I get to invoke Perl and Larry Wall has done all the hard work for it. What motivates you to spend even more time? Is it that you're eventually going to save more time, or is it just you're going to be less frustrated?
Well, I also kind of build my own car engines.
I've seen a theme here, definitely.
I mean, I'm an engineer. I like to build things. And kind of I have to force myself to stop reinventing everything because then I'll get nothing done, and to focus on a couple of things. So I've kind of decided to focus on compilers that, you know, that's what I'm going to get done and do properly rather than reinventing everything. I have to stop myself from building a debugger. I have to stop myself from building an integrated development environment, all these other things, and have to, you know, resign myself to be satisfied with what other people do. But the compiler I want to control. I still think I'm the only person who's created a C++ compiler from source code to executable. Everyone else only works on parts of a compiler. So I was kind of in an ideal situation to develop a D compiler is because I had a, you know, back-end optimizer, all the other tools all ready to go. I just needed to build a new front end for it.
Okay, so as you're designing a language, what's the thought process involved? I mean, you probably start with all the things you like from the other languages that you use, and then you put those in, and then you leave out everything that you don't like from there. But how do you then fill in the gaps? How do you figure out what's still missing in the language?
There are two ways to figure out what's missing. One is to write programs in it, and then you very quickly find out what is missing. And the other is to listen to what other people say about it, and they'll tell you what's missing. Nobody's really shy about telling you what they don't like and what's missing. So suggestions for improvements come in several on a daily basis. So Andre and I are quite painfully aware of what is missing and where the gaps are. And in fact, our most difficult job is saying no, because we simply, it's humanly impossible to implement everything everybody says they want. So that's really the hardest part of writing a language, is not so much filling in the gaps, but saying no to everyone's favorite feature that they want in the language.
Well, and a lot of people are also coming at it from a perspective of, well, I had this in this language that I really liked, and all of a sudden now you don't have it in D yet, so you should add it because I really like it when it was in this language, and I can't use that language anymore if I'm using it with D, right?
You are so right. Like when I first learned Fortran, and then when I learned C, all my early C programs look like Fortran programs. All my C++ programs look like C programs, and you know, my earlier D programs all look like C++ programs. So people come to D from Java, and they try to write Java in D, and they complain because it doesn't quite match up with what Java does. They'll also come from C++, and they'll try to write C++ code in D, and it doesn't quite fit. You kind of have to write D in an idiomatic way. If you try to do things the traditional C++ way, you're going to be a little bit frustrated. You have to kind of change the way you think about programming to program successfully in D.
And just so we get to Andre some more screen time here, Andre, how did you get involved with the project?
Thanks. Let me add something to what Walter said, because it wasn't mentioned, and I guess he can't toot his horn on horn about that. I think taste is an interesting and important quality of a good language designer. And Walter has plenty of taste. Let me be on record with that. I really believe that there's a lot of people who are theoretically very, very skilled in the theory of programming languages, but they lack taste, and they build artifacts, languages, and additions to languages, and so on, that are very mathematically or theoretically very accurate and very precise, but they lack taste. And Walter has taste. This is a nice thing. It's very difficult to just start from scratch and kind of build a language to the point where it does something interesting in taste. So, all right. So your question. How did I get involved? Well, it turns out it was a beer.
all right.
Yeah, beer makes everything happen.
Beer does make everything happen. So what happened was Walter and I both lived in Seattle. I was a graduate student. And we met for a beer. It was late 2005 or 2006. No, it was earlier than that. It was 2005, I think, yeah. So Walter and I meet for a beer in the U District. I remember he was afraid of being robbed because he hadn't been there in a long time, and the U District is kind of odd at night. So anyhow, we meet in the district, and we head for a beer, and I'm saying your language D sucks, awful, and I have a much better language project which I called Enki, E-N-K-I, and this is kind of my project, and I'm gonna go forward with it. And Walter kind of talked me out of it and into, working on D instead. And that's because he said, I think his manipulation was actually factually true, in the sense that he mentioned it's very difficult to get everything working. You may get a language to the proof of concept state, but getting it, crossing all the T's and everything, and getting all done, like really 100% is very difficult. And most programming languages remain in that stage with three users and a pile of code that's in proof of concept and a crappy compiler and a crappy front end and a crappy back end and nothing to be to write home about. So, and he said, you know, here's the thing. This is a nice language, but we need to take it to the next level. And, you know, we need a guy like you to, you know, I need a guy like you to, so we can work together and we can do like, we can take this to the next level. And, you know, the rest is history, as they say. I'm not sure to what extent we've succeeded at that grand ambition. But anyhow, D has transformed a lot since 2006. We've just added incredibly powerful features to it. And probably the most interesting thing about D, which is worth studying, even if you don't have a particular interest in coding in D at the moment, I think it's how interoperability of different programming paradigms is smoothly done together. We have pure functions, there's immutable data, there's also mutable data you can change, like classic imperative programming, there's objects, and there's a generic program, and there's even code generation, generative abilities. And all of these are packed like really nice, fit together, dovetail really nicely in ways that I haven't seen in other languages. It's really beautiful, and it's like good decode looks good when you look at it, especially if it's syntax colored. So it really looks good. It looks good on the page, like, huh, I can understand that. And by contrast, there's a bunch of code in other languages that shan't be mentioned that just doesn't look good on the page when it does what it's supposed to mean. As an example of another language that of which code may look good on the page when it's there, for example, good Python code may look good on the page. Good Ruby code may look good on the page. However, decode is. Well, I'm hearing something.
Sorry about that.
sorry. I just had a little cough there. Okay, never mind.
But unlike Python and Ruby, decode is also blazingly fast. So it looks good and it runs good.
So, guys, I'm interested. I'm going to jump back to Walter for a second first, I think. The kind of the history that you were talking about of the project is really fascinating. What I'm curious to know is how has adoption kind of picked up on this? How many people are using D? Do you have a... I'm not asking you for an exact number. I realize that's a bit difficult. But, you know, at what kind of levels are we seeing for users and stuff? Has it got the adoption that you hoped it would or that you wanted it to?
I want to... first touch a little bit of base on what Andre said before. One of my motivating things is that decode looks good on a piece of paper. And I remember a slide from one of Andre's presentations on other languages once. And I remember thinking, there's just no way that can ever look good. There's no way to format it to make it look good. So for me, that's a very large goal with the, so now I forgot what your question was.
Adoption, yeah. I was curious about the adoption of the language.
Oh, the adoption rate. Yeah. Andre has better numbers, but...
I'm the scientist. I'm with the numbers.
Yeah, and the... it started out very small, and it's been slowly gaining momentum. I think Andre said at one point we had 10,000 users. Based on download statistics, and that's probably a reasonable number.
So I have more recent numbers, actually, which are interesting. So we've been looking, like, for example, 2012, we had a few thousand downloads a month. So I'm looking month over month, how many people actually go and download the binaries. And that only counts the main downloads, but the decompiler is also distributed with a number of Linux distributions, so those are not counted. So it's a low bound, right? Of course, there's a lot of people who are going to download the thing and then kind of look at it and then throw it away. So probably there's some balance there. Anywho, the interesting thing is since the beginning of the year, I just gathered statistics a couple of weeks ago. To my surprise, at the beginning of the year, we had a steady 10,000 downloads a month. Which is, okay, sounds good. So I can estimate our user base in the five digits. But only since the beginning of the year until now, the number of monthly downloads has tripled to about 30,000 a month. And I guess that's it's not a precise measure of how many users we actually have, but you know, it's a very good proxy, a very good indicator that we are experiencing like very good growth.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, one thing I was curious about is the obviously getting a new getting adoption for a new language, especially something like D. There's so much code, an unbelievable amount of code in C and C++. C++ already out there. How easily can you interact with things like libraries, maybe C libraries and things like that? I'm going to direct that towards Walter. Is that okay?
Okay, yes, sure. D was designed from the ground up to be ABI compatible with C. So if you've got C code, you can talk to it from D without any proxies, marshaling, or translation layers. C++ is a little more difficult, but we've made some very good progress on interoperability with C. The name mangling works. Namespaces work now. Template name mangling works. So if you have a C++ template, you can actually call it from D. Sometimes you need to be a little bit, well, actually often you need to be a bit flexible on both the C++ side and the D side in order to get them to talk to each other because, you know, D is not C++ and it doesn't have exact feature parities. Things are done in different ways in D. But if you're a little bit flexible, you can find common ground between them and then, you know, your code can cross the boundary between them. And we're working on improving that. Specifically, Andre and I are working on trying to make the exception handling system interoperate between the two languages.
Excellent, because I imagine that must, I mean, I seem like I'm obsessed with adoption, but that has a big impact on things like adoption because there's so much C out there, so much C++ already.
You're right.
One thing Yeah,
you're right. People have enormous code bases in C, and if you don't interoperate with C, you know, you're faced with having to rewrite everything, such as libssl, the crypto library. And as everyone knows, you don't really want to go sit down and write a crypto library in an afternoon. You want to leverage something that's already done and that's correct. So in addition to their C code, they have enormous amounts of C++ code. That's why Andre and I put C++ interoperability as a very high priority, and we want to make a lot more progress with that to make it a lot easier for people to adopt D and not have to throw away or rewrite their existing C++ code base.
Hmm. I was just saying to Randall there that you used the example of SSL, but libssl may need rewriting considering the events of this year, or maybe not. What about? I was looking through some of the D stuff. I confessed to Randall at the start that I used to be a Java developer many years ago, so I'm familiar with garbage collection, or should I say lack of garbage collection in certain places. Where you end up with, you know, this kind of inflation of memory leaks and so on. I noticed you've got a kind of an optional garbage collector in D. So how does that work? Is that giving people the choice to just either go with automatic garbage collection or do something more kind of classical, like manage or, you know, very tightly manage the memory themselves? How does that work?
Okay. You can allocate memory in D using the garbage collector. Or you can allocate it on the stack, which actually turns out to be the fastest way to allocate memory. You can call C's mallocin free directly. There's no layer in there, and you can manage it manually like you would in C. And Andre and I are working on a reference counting system, so you can choose to allocate memory and have it reference counted. So you really have a great deal of choice. With how you manage memory. You're not required to use one or the other. Now, there are some parts of the runtime library which rely on the garbage collector, and those parts can be avoided if you don't want to use the garbage collector. But the community is also working on making some refinements to Phobos so that it's either parameterized or agnostic about how the memory is managed. For example, if you have an algorithm that goes from one data structure to another, like converts Unicode strings from one format to another. You could construct the algorithm without having the algorithm need to be concerned about the memory allocation. And that's done by using templates and parameterized types with it.
By the way, to define Phobos, it's the standard library.
Phobos. Yeah. It comes from, it was originally called the Mars programming language. So, you know, Phobos orbits Mars. So, you know, that's why the runtime library is called Phobos.
And there's Deimos too, which is a bunch of C wrappers over C libraries, Phobos and Deimos, right? Dan, may I add just a bit to what Walter said? It's been our party line for a long time that D has an optional garbage collector, and you get to opt in that, and you know, essentially all of this all of these options can use the garbage collector, of course, stack allocation, and malloc and free, for example, or your own allocators. There's a bit more nuance to that, which you know is coming to a head, in a way nowadays. And I'm very happy we are really focused on this right now. The matter being, how easy is it to use the without the garbage collector? And our grand ambition here is to make D, including its core runtime and standard library, usable with a completely unplugged garbage collector. And this is we have a sort of a two-pronged attack here. One is to essentially take a page from C++'s book, because C++ has been at this for 35 years now. So mm-hmm. it's been at achieving expressiveness without a garbage collector for many decades, right? And a lot of VDMs and a lot of things have been successful, some not as much in C++. And we want to take a page from C++'s book and go with their successful paradigms. For example, shared PTR, smart pointers that are reference counted in C++, big success. Unique pointer, pointers that can have only one owner, big success in C++. The Rust language takes that one step further. It has a much more elaborate mechanism of handling ownership. So we're kind of looking at this landscape here. And remember how we started. I said D aims at doing everything C++ does as good at C++, if not better, and also a lot of stuff in addition to that. To do everything well, as well as C++, again, we got to take what's good from C++. And that means we're looking at a really solid reference counting mechanism. And our hope is that with careful definition, we should be able to allow D to be used without a garbage collector as well as C++. And then there's actually one step further, which is a very modern approach that's coming forward in research of programming languages, which is have a reference counted language with a cycle collector underneath it. So you don't worry about weak pointers and cycles and the classic weaknesses of reference counting. So you can actually use reference counting for early reuse of memory, but you can also have a garbage collector underneath it all that's going to be able to lift cycles and kind of take care of sort of the litter, if you wish.
No, I was just going to ask about the weak pointers and stuff, because I know one of the things that Perl gets criticized on, because it uses reference counting rather than any kind of garbage collection, is the fact that if you have a recursive data structure or a self-referencing data structure, you have to always mark your structures as weak, or mark the back pointers as weak. I know Perl 6, one of its advantages is that they went to full GC behind the scenes. Sounds like it's actually a hybrid of both GC and ref counting.
Right. So that's really coming. Randall, I actually have numbers on that. Our own Facebook's PHP code base, it turns out it has a lot of cycles because PHP also uses reference counting. And we experimented with what if we measure what's going on and we just collect at the end of the request and things like that. So our experimentation showed that, let's say, simple-minded PHP code, like simple scripts, you go through the script at the end, you're good. You know, reference counting takes care of it. But the more sophisticated the code base goes, and Facebook's PHP code is like some really, it's PHP that's really well written, which is paradoxical, but it happens. So we have a large, sophisticated PHP library and code base. And that code turns out 1/3 of all objects are in cycles in some way because they're objects that interoperate and communicate. So it's not a negligible thing. And it's very difficult to frame it as a engineer attention kind of problem and say, oh, you should use weak pointers and whatnot. I think this notion of reference counting plus a lift cycle collector is a great idea, and we plan to march on it.
One of the downsides of having some sort of other kind of like a garbage collection, though, is that it has unpredictable runtimes. If you're doing some real-time applications, you don't get to use that. So would you have a way of turning that off and use strictly reference counting and promise to do the weak pointers yourself?
Right. So we're considering it's not a done deal because it's a very complex problem, right? It's not a done deal, but we're considering thinking things like, you know, you choose at build time whether or not you're going to enable the garbage collector, and then you have taken care for you. Give me just a second. My phone is ringing.
Okay, great. Well, Walter, I have a question for you.
Okay, you can bend my ear for a while here.
I have a question for you. So given that this is multi-paradigm at the garbage collection level, at the programming level, you know, whether you want to use imperative programming or whether you want to use objects, things like that, then how does this scale for a team of programmers? Do you have to develop coding standards that say on this particular project we're only going to use imperative programming? I mean, how do you interoperate when multiple people are writing into the code base?
Oh, that is a very good question. I know that C++ has this because people wind up developing in particular islands of the language.
Yep.
And, you know, I think that probably is going to happen with D as well, because there are different styles of programming you can adopt, and you just kind of pick the style that your team is comfortable with. I do believe that the features interoperate with each other much better than in C++, but it's kind of hard to explain that. It's just something, a feeling you get after using it for a while. I do know that there are people in both C++ and D who will use every feature of the language. I tend to be more conservative in my own code and kind of stick more towards the center of the street. But there are people who take great pleasure in using the expressive power to the max. And if you've got, I can see where people can argue about what is, you know, the right solution for a particular problem. I mean, C does offer you a smorgasbord, and at some point you're going to have to pick if you like the fish or the beef.
Right. We have a similar, the reason I'm thinking of this, we have a similar problem in Perl, in that we've had over the years many different object frameworks like Moose and things like that added on top of the language, and also many different web frameworks like Catalyst versus other things like that. But even more at the fundamental level, since the Perl has, as part of its motto, more than one way to do it, people say, well, I can declare my variables this way, or I can declare them that way, I can write my packages and modules this way, or I can write them that way. And so we're already seeing problems like that. I'm sure Perl doesn't even have the flexibility as a multi-paradigm language, although to a certain degree it is, that D would have. Have teams are using D develop like coding standards, in-house coding standards, as they get larger? Or have you seen teams that have gotten so big that anybody's worried about that yet?
There's been talk about it. Nobody likes a vacuum. So we kind of created our own D style guide and put it up on the website, and that seems to make people happy. So D the language doesn't specify a naming convention, so we came up with a naming convention, because if we don't specify one, people are all going to invent their own and they're going to be different from each other. Some features of D are deliberately targeted to avoid a diaspora of different ways of doing things. For example, I had a C++ program manager complain to me once that everybody developed their own way of inserting debug code into a program in C++, and every team had a different scheme, and none of them were actually better than the other. They were all just different, and they didn't interoperate. So D has a feature called debug compile conditionals, and that's how you insert debugging code in your program. And so we've actually been able to eliminate some of the diaspora of various ways of doing things by providing either a recommended way to do things or by providing an actual language feature. Another thing of that is documentation. Lots of people use third-party tools to run over their source code to generate documentation, but D has a built-in documentation support, and so people gravitate to simply using the built-in support instead of inventing their own. The same with unit testing. Instead of having a third-party tool, which has its own ideas about unit testing, though of course nothing stops you from using that in D, there is a way that the language supports unit testing, and we've been actually very surprised at how strongly people have embraced that. Unit testing has really become part of the culture of writing D code, and to the point where if you're not shipping unit tests with your code, it looks unprofessional. And to me, that's a very pleasing state we've reached, where people are actually embarrassed to publish D code without a set of unit tests that go with it. And I don't know of any other language where this has happened. So yes, there are still different ways of doing things, but there are also a lot of unifying ways of doing things in D that have turned out surprisingly well.
Well, I was going to ask about that unit testing, because I know one of the sort of unifying things across multiple languages now is this thing, the TAP protocol, test anything protocol. And I'm wondering if your unit tests output the TAP protocol so I can merge in with other things like Jenkins and other build systems.
I'm not familiar with the TAP protocol, but what D also offers is a built-in tool to do coverage testing. It's called the dash cov switch. All you do is throw that and you run your unit tests, and it'll generate a report saying which lines you executed and which lines you didn't, including lines in your templates and things like that. And we found this, again, to be astonishingly useful, because you can write a bunch of units and almost instantly test to see if you're actually testing your code. I don't know how that fits into the TAP because I'm not familiar with that, but we found the dash cov switch to be extremely useful. It's not an add-on tool. It's built right into the compiler.
Very cool. Very cool. Well, this is for either of you again, now that I know that Andre's back again. What's contract programming, and how would I use it?
I'm back, but I'll let Walter talk about it.
Okay.
Contract programming is basically asserts. The idea is to have programs self-check themselves for logic bugs in it. For example, testing to see that the inputs are legal, and then testing to see that the output is correct. For example, contracts for a sort program would be in your out contract, when the function is done, checking to see that the return result is actually sorted.
Cool.
I have in fact, there's a debate currently going on in the community about what constitutes a logic problem for which assert is the correct solution, and what constitutes, input or malformed input or an environmental error, which I would argue the correct response is to throw an exception, which is not contract programming. Contract programming is only for internal consistency checks that look for programming bugs.
Okay. Also, I noticed that there was no multiple inheritance. You didn't inherit that problem from C++, or from Java, I think it is, right? So how do you get away with just single inheritance?
Walter, may I take that?
Yes.
Java has multiple inheritance of interface. It doesn't have multiple inheritance of implementation. C++ has multiple inheritance of full-blown of implementation. And in my opinion, that turned out to be a failure. It's just unwieldy. The rules are unwieldy complicated. It's just bizarre. It's difficult to get right in any design. And essentially, I think it's a net loss. I've seen it used successfully in a few designs. It's just very niche and very difficult. So we opted out of that. Multiple inheritors of interface Java style doesn't have any of those problems because it doesn't share state from multiple paths. So we do have, however, since 1 week from now, we do have it's not multiple inheritance, but it's multiple subtyping, which is an interesting distinction. There's a feature in DU which is called alias this. We call it alias this, and it means you can have an object implicitly masquerade as a number of interfaces. For years, that has been implemented. You can only have one alias this in a class or structure, which means there's only one possible path to inheritance to the subtyping. But Igor Stepanov, one of our contributors, has recently implemented multiple alias this, which is described from the future in my book, the deprogramming language. So I described the feature and I said it's not implemented yet, but we plan to implement it. That was 2009, and it's been like years since then. And finally, Igor stepped in and implemented the thing. And multiple subtyping does not have any of the problems that C++'s multiple inheritance has, but it shares a bunch of the advantages in real designs. So that's actually literally like nowadays, it's been under scrutiny, and Igor is working on a formalization of the approach. He has the implementation already, but we want the formalization to be in place as well. And once that's in, we're going to have yet another very, very solid, expressive tool that makes sense. Is also like, it may lead to good designs. It fosters good designs.
Cool. And one of the things that since this language is, you know, like the next C or whatever it is, a couple of places that I see C at, and I'm wondering if D is also apropos, and either you can take this question, is embedded systems where you need the code to all compile down to a very small library that you can do tree shaking on, so you only get just the parts you need, versus also something like, say, the Linux kernel. Could I rewrite the Linux kernel in D and get the same sort of performance and speed and low-level access? So whoever wants to answer that, go ahead.
Okay. I used to do embedded systems, so I guess I can handle that. If you're writing a 4K program, or you have a 4K prom to put it in, you're really best off writing it in assembly or assembler language. If you're writing up to a 64K program and you really have a hard limit on that amount of memory, probably C is your best bet. But if you have more memory available, D makes an excellent program for language for doing embedded systems. You can write D code. You can almost take C code and rename the file to D, and with some, not a whole lot of edits, make it work. And when you write D code in a C style, you will get C performance and C generated code. So you're really not restricted. The runtime for D is bigger than the runtime for C++. However, it is possible, and people have done it, to strip out the runtime and run it bare bones. It's also possible to do that, and people have done it. So yes, you can do it, and it's fairly well suited to it. But you know, really, if you're really memory tight with proms, you know, you should seriously consider either assembly language or C for, you know, very small memory footprint systems. The advantages of D start showing up when your programs are getting larger, not when they're very tiny.
Okay. A couple more questions again for either of you. I don't know who answers these the best for some of the things that I came up with. Again, I didn't have a lot of time to research D. I've been, you know, pawing my way through the book that I guess, Andre, you wrote. And I got about halfway through, and I had a couple questions just from reading that part of it. One of the things I see is that hashes can have complex keys like strings and things like that. And I'm wondering if the keys are based on identity, equality, or something else.
There's a notion of equality. For example, you have string keys. They're going to be compared character by character, not the pointers. Strings in D are not interned. Java has this so-called notion of interning, which means all identical strings actually have the same address. This is not the case in D, so it compares strings the sort of the classic way lexicographically. There's also a notion of is. So if you compare A equal equal B, you get comparison for equality, and that's all fine and nice. But you can actually test whether two objects are two names refer to the same actual object in memory, which is the is operator. So if you say A is B, is being a keyword, in that case, you get like exact identity that as you were mentioning. So that's how it goes. It's comparison for equality, and there's going to be a real comparison there.
Okay, but does a hash key use identity or equality?
Equality.
Equality, great. Okay, that's so. Can I define an arbitrary equality operator? Like if I have first name, last name, I can say you can do it by comparing the two first names as for equality, then the two last names for equality?
Yes. Yeah, and they actually has a nice, as I mentioned, an elegant approach to user-defined operators. So Walter, long before I joined the project, instead of getting nice with syntax like C++ does with, you know, you say operator this, operator that, and kind of there's syntax to it, and there's a lot of parsing that's dedicated to that kind of construct. Instead, he said, you know what, there's going to be a naming convention. So if you say OP equals with capital E and everything else is lowercase, OP equals, if you just define that guy as a method in your class or struct, it's just going to mean it's going to be automatically invoked whenever a comparison is involved for equality. And there's not, you know, there's not a sort of a fuzzy set. It's like, you know, OP equals is going to be invoked for both equal and not equal, the negation thereof. Similarly, you have only one operator for comparing for all less than or greater than, less than or equal, etc. comparisons. There's only one operator. Don't need to define like four, which is kind of just a lot of work to do. And it's, you know, you can't get it wrong and stuff like that. So it's a naming convention. And the semantics of the, which is very nice, the semantics of the code is defined in terms of what we call lowerings, meaning you take a piece of D code that's high level and the compiler sort of rewrites it into sort of simpler code with explicit function calls and stuff like that, and then it proceeds from there. And that makes, we noticed, makes the features very easy to understand for users because they say, oh, so that's what for each means. It's like a for with these, you know, these adornments on top of it. And I understand for, so therefore I understand for each. Similarly, I understand how to call a method. Therefore, I understand how objects are compared for equality.
Very cool, yeah. Very cool. And I also, another thing, go ahead, sorry, Walter.
Yeah, it turns out in the back end, there's only one loop implemented, and that's the for loop. And all the loops in the front end, you know, for loops, while loops, for each loops, do while loops, all are turned into for loops. And so The back end only has one set of semantics to execute, which makes it much less prone to errors, and it also makes it consistent. So that's
a
big advantage.
Nice. I have one other sort of really geeky question that I'm going to let Dan ask some maybe slightly less geeky questions. As I was going past the area on scope, I noticed that the inner scope, unlike many languages I'm familiar with, the inner scope doesn't override the outer scope. So if I have an outer variable called I can't have an inner scope that also defines a variable I. Can you explain why that particular paradigm was chosen? It seems a bit backwards to me.
Okay, it does override the outer scope, except in certain cases, inner scopes override outer scopes as far as overloading goes and that sort of thing. However, it turns out that a common error in programming is defining a variable called I in your local scope in your function and then redefining it on an interior scope and then getting thinking that they're the same variable. And this is a very common programming bug. And so we decided that was a something called shadowing, where the one in the inner scope is shadowing the one in the outer scope. So we decided to make a rule, which turned out to be very successful, is that if you, that shadowing of local variables is simply not allowed. Now, if you have a global variable named I, then it overrides it. But and for inner scopes, it doesn't. And so when you're looking at a declaration for I, you know that that holds true for the entire function block. It's not overridden. It turns out that there are some coding standards for C and C++ that disallow having shadowing variables. And D just kind of says, you know, why make a standard for that? It's clearly the right practice to do. Let's just code it into the language and stop worrying about it.
So
we've
one
actually
of the problems,
done that for a lot of things, yeah.
One of the problems I would find with that is that that means that every, you know, if I have, say, a 100-line function, which you would probably argue, well, that's too long for a function anyway then, but if I have a 100-line function and I've got maybe a couple of inner scopes that I've used like a temporary I in both of those, but then I also define an I in the function but outside the two inner scopes, I now get a problem that has a bug somewhere else. I get the compiler error down at the inner scope, when in fact it wasn't the inner scope's problem. It was the fact that I added the I at the outer level. And this is what I'm seeing. I mean, you're making two different distinct cases for shadowing. You're saying global versus function. Sure, you can do that. That's nice. But I'm saying function within inner scope and function. I'm not quite understanding why that's being treated differently.
Let me just insert a factoid here. I remember the afternoon in which Walter actually experimented with that feature. He found bugs in the standard library, period. I mean, it was interesting. He turned it on and it was like, oh, so that's a mistake, actually. And another one was back when he introduced this feature. I was a grad student. I was doing my machine learning implementation in D, and I found bugs in my code with that rule. So that's an interesting factoid suggesting that there is real merit to that value. And let me, Randall, let me stress just a bit this notion of globals can be shadowed okay, but not other locals, which is very interesting. And the purpose of that is you can't add a global and break code elsewhere. Because let's say you use I or whatever, ABC as a name in some function, and assume you add at some point a global called ABC. And at that point, you know, it shouldn't be a breaking code that's sort of outside your realm, right? So that's right. Why you can shadow globals, but you can't shadow other locals because that's a problem that can be corrected locally. So it's an issue. This whole name choosing is a local issue that can be solved locally. And I think it's a matter in which reasonable people may disagree. So there's, you know, actually I like this whole hiding thing, you know, I would let me just submit that in my experience it's actually found actual bugs and it's been good. And whenever it hits you, it's easy to fix.
But not only does it find bugs frequently, even if you intentionally shadowed the variables, it looks like a bug because it's so often a bug. So every time you see that in a code, it raises, in my mind anyway, a suspicion that it's broken. And then I have to carefully go through and verify, oh, he really did intend it to use the same name on an inner scope. So part of D is designed so that it's easier for people to do code reviews. And one of those ways to do code reviews is to disallow things that are red flags as being a poor practice for them. Because so even if you want to do it, it looks like a bug. And that causes extra effort to deal with. So why not just make the thing not possible to have in D?
Okay, guys. Given the discussion that you've just been having, this question from IRC is incredibly relevant. We've got a question from RORX in the IRC who says, do you have any interest in formalizing D standards by ISO or a similar global standard? I don't know who wants to take that one.
The time isn't right for it, but absolutely yes. I think you know, the more successful D becomes, the more there'll be a need to do a global standard.
And now that the topic of formalization came up, we really So there's two ways of formalizing things. So one is by means of a standard, but there's also like by means of a formal definition of the language. And people have started actually missing that. They're like, oh, I don't know exactly how the language is defined here because there's a specification, but it's in natural language, essentially. So there's a bit of a pressure increasing on the side of we want this to be formalized by means of, like formal proof, like theoretical programming languages kind of work. And let me use this venue for an appeal to researchers out there. I believe this is a very interesting language to do research on. And I think there's a lot of good, solid, theoretically motivated and principled idea in it. And if the right theoretician comes along, yeah, I'd be very happy to work with them. That would be awesome.
That sort of brings up another point. Andre was very kind in saying what I brought to the D language. I'm an engineer. I build things. But Andre is a scientist. He looks at language from a academic, more theoretical point of view, or as I kind of look at it from the completely opposite point of view. And what Andre has brought to D is rigor to the language. So we kind of make good partners because we each have skills that the other lacks. Our skills are complementary. So he is not at all a clone of me, and I'm not a clone of him. We're completely different. I look at things from the engineer's point of view, and he looks at it from the scientist's point of view, and neither of those is completely correct. But together, I think we get a lot closer to making things right.
What are you saying? Of course, the scientific perspective is the correct one.
Yeah, but you and I argue when you say, I want to do it this way, and says, I can't make that work properly, or it's not going to work very well. So, and he tells me, well, you've got a big hole in your design there that you can drive a truck through. And I go, oh, you know, and so, yeah, we're both needed.
That's cool. So, what about your kind of roadmap and what you've got planned for the future of D? I know things change all the time, but do you have any formal roadmap there or anything you're planning for the future?
Our biggest, we listen to the users on that, and our users right now, a lot of them come from a C++ background, and they have existing C++ code, and we constantly hear, I really want to use D, but I cannot throw away my C++ code and rewrite it. So find us a way to interoperate with our existing C++ code base. So that's what Andre and I are working on as our top priority. And that includes having an improved way or more flexible ways of managing memory. So it's really right up what Andre said. You know, that's our roadmap, at least for the near future.
Okay.
Then there's one extra thing on the roadmap, probably even before this too, which is kind of going meta. The top thing on our roadmap right now is communicating the roadmap, because there's been there's been a bit of a kerfuffle in the community about, you know, we want to know what the direction is, and that's entirely reasonable. And we've been so busy doing things that we sometimes are like, oh, of course, C++ interoperability and working on GC are like really good things to do right now, and they're really top priority, and we should get them done sooner than later. But people come, when did you say that? And how, you know, they need a sort of a more structured way of communication of what our intents and purposes are longer term, a more of a vision communication. And I guess that's, should be on our roadmap first and foremost. There's been proposals of starting a blog or making a weekly or monthly sort of newsletter authored by Walter and myself about, you know, where we think things are going and what's going on and what's happening. And I think these are great ideas by the community, and you know, we'll have to do it because it comes with the territory. We got to do it.
Yeah, it sounds like perhaps you guys should do a podcast, to be honest, because you seem to be pretty.
There you go, fantastic.
All right, so I want to ask a little bit about. I'm afraid it falls to me to ask the kind of I knew he said dirty question. That's not the right word. But a lot of the projects that we have on, we like to try and establish, you know, how they're supported and so on, and not just financially, but like in governance and so on. So is this a labor of love for you guys, or do you get paid to work on it? Or is there any kind of company involvement there?
My company is sort of wound up being in charge of it. It's called Digital Mars, and it's the company that makes the C++ compilers that I've been in business with for a long time. Financially, it's run as a, you know, free software, and I support it as necessary. I believe Andre works for Facebook. My full-time job is working on D. So we're not really trying to make money off of it. We're not making money off of it. It's a labor of love for us. We're not constrained by having to make money off of it. So we're doing our best to do what is right for the language rather than what is right for some other agenda. D's not being used to sell some other product or promote something else. It is its own thing, and we want to do what is best for D.
Mm-hmm. And that leads me quite nicely. You mentioned the licensing thing there. So it's free software. So what kind of license is it under, and why did you take that decision?
Back in the 80s, I wrote proprietary software, and I believed in closed source, and I believe in, you know, holding all my cards close to the vest. And the free source ideas have really taken a while, but they've really grown on me, and I found that making things free and open really works better. It, for one of the big reasons, is it gets people involved with D. If I was trying to hide the source code for it, we'd have basically no, you know, probably three users. But we liked open source so much, and it works so well for us, that we decided to make it as open source as possible, which meant the most open source license we could find was the C++ Boost license. It's short, simple, to the point, pretty much means you can do anything with it. You can use it for commercial projects. You can use it for closed source. You can use it for open source. You can translate it and use our code in your favorite language. We find that this just pays us back in spades, having it to be open source with as few restrictions as possible. And we really believe in that. It's working great for us.
Mm-hmm. That sounds great. Hey, we're almost out of time, and I mean we really are almost out of time. It's not just like I'm saying that sometimes. But I do have two more questions for each of you. So I'll start first with Andre. Is there anything we didn't ask that you want to make sure our audience is aware of, keeping in mind we're almost out of time? And the second question is, what's your favorite text editor?
All right, Emacs.
Yay! Yay! Finally! Finally! All right. And anything else that we haven't covered that you want to make sure our audience is aware of?
I think you guys have been asking like the most embarrassing questions, which is good.
So, we're good at that.
I think the whole, you know, what looking forward and what are the plans, and I think this is sort of the big thing that's on my mind right now, and we have like huge ambitions for D. We really want to get to 1 million plus users. We really want to, and I believe we really will. It's a long road, and it's a difficult road, but we're on it. We're just making step by step, and it's just happening. With regard to you know, who's paying for this, what, you know, what was the user base and stuff like that. Facebook has been picking up on D quite a bit. There's been a few open source projects, open source by Facebook and maintained by Facebook, written in D. And there's just a lot of things happening right now, that most of which I can't unfortunately disclose right now. But I'm very optimistic that Facebook's involvement with D is going to only grow. Facebook has sponsored the past D conferences in the past 2 years, and I hope we're going to get sponsorship for the next event as well, probably in May 2015. And I really hope that Facebook will be a good steward for a large D contributor base. That said, there's already a couple of corporations that are using the significantly. The biggest one is Sociomantic in Germany. It's a high-speed ads company, and they're using exclusively D. And they have a large installation. They have great results. They're like really successful using the language. There's a lot of smaller companies using it. We hope that corporate adoption is only going to increase. And I hope in a way, I'm actually confident that that growth is going to come about in a way that's going to allow us to, again, as Walter said, do what's best for the language, not for any particular interest and entity in the language. So, I think the theme here is I'm very optimistic about where we are and where we're going right now.
Very cool. Very good. And Walter, same two questions again, keeping in mind, we're almost out of time.
Okay. The editor I use is a heavily modified version of Dave Conroy's Micro Remax program.
Okay.
It's kind of very personal. The second thing is about D, is I feel like working with the D community and developing D code, and it's the language I always wanted to have, and I finally have it, that I've got the second best job in the world. And you might ask what the best job in the world is, and that would have been my dad's, who actually got paid to fly P-51 Mustangs. So I can't do that, but I can work on D, and, you know, it gets me up every morning. It's an exciting job. I love working with the D community and interacting with them. They always have fantastic ideas about how to make things better. And for a guy who's kind of sort of on the towards the autistic end of the spectrum, it's really fun to be able to work with a large group of people. I never thought I'd be able to do it, and seeing their pleasure in using the language is a source of enormous satisfaction to myself.
Very good, very good. Hey, this has been fascinating having you guys on. I wish we had more time. We could probably do another hour on some of the other questions I had sitting in my queue here. But thank you guys both for coming in and representing the D programming language.
Our Thanks. Pleasure.
Now you get to have fun at us, right?
Yeah, we're going to talk a bunch behind your back. Yeah, thanks. That was Andre and Walter talking about D. We don't have a lot of time to do the wrap-up, but I did want to say that coming up next week, we do have Docker. Which we had a delay once. Docker, of course, a big subject in people are doing virtualization and things. I won't list off the rest of the list. Go to twit.tv/floss. Our big spreadsheet's listed from there. We're still filling the rest of Q4. You can follow us on Floss Weekly and Google+. You can also see Floss Weekly on Twitter and Identica. We do have a live chat. We took some questions from there. You can see my postings about that all the time. I will say that this weekend coming up, I'm going to be in the Ketchum, Idaho area, Sun Valley area. Scott Jordan, the guy who makes Scotty Vest clothes, which I am a big user of, is having his 50th birthday party. So if you're in the Ketchum, Idaho area, please get a hold of me, and I'll probably have a little bit of time here and there to hang out. I'm going to be in London on November 29th for a meetup. More about that later. And I'll be at the Brick House on New Year's Eve. So that's sort of my upcoming schedule. Dan, anything real quick?
No, not really. We've just done Og Camp, so go and check that out. It's ogcamp.org. We had that last weekend. Or go to danlynch.org, and I'm sure I'll be writing about it and tweeting about it and all kinds of other things.
Very good, very good. And Dan, once again, thanks for joining me on this show, and it worked out really well, so thank you.
No problem. It's always fun.
And we'll see you on November 29th, maybe, if we work the schedule out for that. All right. So we'll see you all again next week on Floss Weekly.